Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Happy 2025 from the local news roundup. We begin with a look at how the city enjoyed a much more peaceful New Year's Eve with a new site for the main party in Uptown. North Carolina's new governor officially took the reins on Wednesday, while a spat between medic and fire department could cause havoc. We'll look back at Jimmy Carter's 1987 visit to Charlotte in remembrance of the former president who died this week. And the Panthers hope to play spoiler in their season finale Sunday, despite a seventh straight losing campaign. Here to discuss these stories and more are WBTV Chief Investigative Reporter Nick Oxner, WSOC's Joe Bruno, Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte, and WFAE Senior Editor Eli Portillo. Good morning and welcome to all.
Morning.
Hey.
So almost a year to the day after the shooting at Romare Bearden Park left five people injured, Davion Crawford was sentenced to 20 to 36 months in prison with some time already served. He pleaded guilty to assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury. Joe, you reported on this story. What stood out to you?
Well, there was some, first of all, New Year's Eve was pure chaos last year. So the pressure was going to be on Charlotte officials and CMPD to ensure that this year's event would be a success. And for the most part, it was. There, from what I'm told, there were some arrests this year, but it was nowhere near like last year. They ended up moving the event to Truist Field. They charged admission. They had a ton of security out in Romare Bearden Park. And as a result, it was, for the most part, a pretty well-run evening.
But you also covered the sentencing, I believe, and one of the things that you noted in your report was there was no apology, correct?
Correct. There was no apology. One of the victims who spoke to the judge in the courtroom was a little upset about the sentence as well being so short, 20, 36 with credit for a year. But that was the plea deal reached by Mecklenburg County's district attorney's office. And the judge was pretty stern in her words, Carla Archie, in saying that this is unacceptable. I don't want to see you back here again.
You mentioned the move to Truist Field. Charlotte Center City Partners said that was not related to what happened last year. Any idea why they decided to do this? Apparently it worked better.
Center City Partners claims that they've been trying to do this for years. Maybe that's the case. It was conveniently timed, though. You had to go through security measures to get into the ballpark. It was a lot more organized this way. And while the shooting wasn't at the Crown Lighting last year, it was a couple blocks away, and people were able to come and go from the Crown Lighting as they pleased. So, you know, it was much more secure this year, whether or not they did it for exactly this purpose.
Obviously, you mentioned last year was a disaster. Five people shot, three CMPD officers hurt, and I think 18 people arrested or cited in Uptown. And for what you know so far, no shootings and fewer people arrested.
Yeah, from what I understand, one of the main issues they dealt with was curfew violations, teens being out too late when they're not supposed to without adult supervision, but certainly haven't heard anything as significant as last year.
Also on New Year's Eve, on his last day in office, Governor Roy Cooper commuted 15 death sentences, or about 10% of the 136 inmates on death row. Eli, how did he decide on these commutations?
Well, the governor's former governor, I'm going to have to get used to that. Former Governor Cooper said that he received, 89 applications from people seeking commutation on death row, and that he weighed factors such as the prisoner's age at the time of the killing, their mental capacity, the circumstances, you know, was it an especially heinous act. Also, whether race might have played a role into it in, you know, any of the proceedings during trial. Ultimately, 15 of these sentences were commuted to life without the possibility of parole. They included crimes such as Elrico Fowler. He was convicted almost 30 years ago of shooting and killing a motel worker at a Howard Johnson in Charlotte during a robbery. Also, for example, a man in Union County who was convicted in the mid-90s of shooting and killing an acquaintance during a drunken argument. You know, North Carolina has not carried out an execution since 2006 because of ongoing legal disputes and, you know, litigation about the death penalty. We've seen this in a lot of states. There are still more than 100 people on the state's death row after this. And, you know, it was about 10% of the total people on death row who had their sentences commuted.
And Joe, I think WSOC reported some pushback on the governor's decision, including from a victim's family in Hickory. What was their
pushback? Yeah, they were upset. They said they were consulted before the commutation, but they said that they preferred for him to remain on death row. And I think that we'll probably hear some more feedback along these lines over the coming weeks of either DAs or family members who just don't agree with the decision.
On Wednesday, the new governor, Josh Stein, took the oath of office at the old Capitol building. A formal ceremony will be held January 11th, a week from Saturday. Here is part of what the new governor had to say.
Today, I stand before you humbled by this responsibility, grateful for this opportunity, and ready to get to work for you, the people of North Carolina.
Stein went on to call for bipartisanship, something he will need as a Democrat in a state with Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate.
We will go further when we go together, not as Democrats, not as Republicans, not as independents, but as North Carolinians.
Nick, what should we expect from Stein in his first year as governor? What are some of his priorities?
Well, he made clear yesterday, and I think we'll talk about this more in a second, but he made clear yesterday his number one priority was disaster recovery in the wake of Hurricane Helene in western North Carolina. And he did so by going to Asheville. And we'll talk about the details of that, I presume, in a second. But I want to highlight one thing that links back to what you just said, though, is that at his first press conference as governor of North Carolina, Josh Stein spoke with a crowd of people behind him that included three Republican lawmakers. So talk about sending a signal of bipartisanship. I was kind of shocked, you know, when I saw Ralph Heiswock get a pretty senior ranking Republican in the Senate. And this, you know, tracks one of the early things he did as Attorney General when he got into office was work with Republicans in the legislature to usher through what became fairly successful funding to clear the rape kit backlog, right, that needed to be tested. And so he actually has a track record of working across the aisle and some bipartisanship. So I think that is, well, it's still early. I'm going to do this rare thing and give a politician the benefit of the doubt here on this show today.
It truly is a new year. Other officials were sworn in, including North Carolina's new attorney general, Jeff Jackson. Jackson resigned his congressional seat this week before becoming attorney general, a move he discussed on TikTok, a platform he promised to remain active on.
Tomorrow, I'll take the oath to become attorney general. And my plan is to approach the communication side of the job in the exact same way. So when something happens that is important and interesting, I'm going to turn on this camera and tell you about it.
So Joe, can Jeff Jackson make Attorney General a viral topic on social media?
Yeah, as long as TikTok isn't banned in 16 days. I think that Jeff Jackson is a skilled communicator and will use whatever social media platform exists. I don't know if TikTok will be the app, though. Trump says he's trying to save it. We'll see what happens.
And, of course, Jeff Jackson, you know, he is also posting all those on X and Facebook. I thought it was interesting that he kind of said, hey, I'm going to keep doing this, because that is, you know, what really brought him some national recognition, was that kind of straightforward, looking at the camera, I'm going to talk to you, one-on-one communications strategy. He does that really well. And, you know, I mean, who knows where we'll be in 8 years, but Attorney General has been the launching pad for North Carolina governors. And once, you know, if Stein is reelected or not, yeah, everyone will be looking and saying, hey, you know, all right, Jeff, is your turn next? So he's going to keep himself in the forefront of conversation and try to keep himself out there in the state as well.
And the right now, go ahead, Alex.
Does tackle some really interesting topics. So I think it will be interesting to see how people react to some of that stuff, like fentanyl, opioids, rape kits. These are things that people are really tuned into. So I think it'll be really impactful to see some of those messages communicated through his platforms.
And as for right now, it is Josh Stein's turn. Nick, you mentioned you were in Asheville yesterday as Governor Stein spent his first full day on the job announcing his first executive orders and making news by disclosing that the Office of Recovery and Resiliency will not be part of relief efforts in Western North Carolina.
More than 12,000 people remain displaced today. And as we are in the coldest months of the year, it is urgent that people have warm and safe places to live now.
Nick, what is the governor promising?
Well, promising is a strong word. He is smarter and more adept than that.
What is he pledging to do? Let me put it.
He's promising to take some action on some things without any definite results in the time-honored tradition of bureaucrats everywhere. Anyways, these five executive orders that he signed yesterday, his first full day as governor, all relate to Hurricane Helene recovery in Western North Carolina. They do a number of things collectively. The first is to steer funding for bridges, private bridges and roads, so that the state can help rebuild private bridges and roads. Those are the top two. That, along with waiving the state's procurement process, which can be lengthy and full of red tape, so that the state can quickly buy more temporary housing. So basically FEMA trailers, these will ultimately be reimbursed by the federal government. They also essentially create a new framework for handling disaster recovery in North Carolina away from NCOR, and we can get into more of the details about that if you can stomach it. And by creating a new entity within his office and also creating a new advisory panel, and then it creates some new regulations to encourage state employees and allow state employees more time, paid time to go volunteer.
Very good. We only have limited time in this segment, so we're going to come back and talk about NCOR, I believe, as it is dubbed, and some of those other pieces that you just outlined with Governor-elect Stein. Stay with us for that. We're also going to talk about some memories of Jimmy Carter, the late president, when he visited Charlotte, and much more. Stay with us right here on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation as part of the Local News Roundup. Our panel includes Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Alex Sands from Axios Charlotte, and Eli Portillo of WFAE. Nick, I interrupted your explanation of the Office of Recovery and Resiliency rolls off the tongue and how it is being phased out. So please continue.
Phased out is the right word. And it was not initially clear from his prepared remarks what was going to happen to NCORE, as it's most commonly referred to. And so my first question to Governor Stein at this press conference yesterday was, well, this is all well and good, but you know, how's NCORE going to do any of this? Not exactly these words, but how is any of this going to happen when NCORE is out of money and ordered contractors to stop building new houses for people in eastern North Carolina impacted by Hurricanes Matthew and Helene nearly a decade ago? And his answer was basically like, oh, well, NCORE is not going to have anything to do with Hurricane Helene recovery. And that is significant, that essentially NCORE, to the extent they get more money from the General Assembly to keep rebuilding from Hurricanes Matthew and Hurricanes Florence, you know, nearly a decade ago, it's more than 100 families. I think it's at least 150, more or less, families that are still without homes, which tells you how successful NCORE was. That's sarcasm for those on the radio. That's why it's being phased out. I just again reported last month that they're being phased. That contractor been ordered to stop new projects. It's the NCORE's executive director resigned late last year, and so it is embattled, to say the least. And so Stein is creating basically a whole separate framework, moving around the pieces within state government that will handle hurricane recovery for Hurricane Helene and or disaster recovery from Hurricane Helene and presumably moving forward.
And clearly, as you said earlier, when I asked you the first question about the governor, the new governor, this is topic A of judging how he does in his first year is storm relief.
Absolutely. I mean, he put that marker down, right? It was pretty, I would say, pretty good optics yesterday, right? I'm going to take action on my first full day. Here I am on the other side of the state talking about a big thing. It's a big topic that, you know, if you recall, Hurricane Helene and the immediate response became a big topic in both the presidential campaign and gubernatorial campaign in the days immediately following Hurricane Helene. And so, you know, nothing says I'm going to jump right on this. And then because we're basically changing the framework for response and recovery, right? Doing away with essentially phasing out an office that Roy Cooper, his predecessor, made and doing his own thing. It's putting down a clean, fresh marker on here's how I, Josh Stein, am going to handle this. And so either that'll be a fresh marker for praise or tune in a couple years when it's a fresh marker for more stories for us to talk about.
Queen City News reported this week that CMPD confirmed a total of 110 homicides in Charlotte in 2024. That's up from 96 in 2023, and the highest total since 2020, when the city had 120 murders. The totals include 5 homicides during the last week of 2024. Eli, any comments or reaction yet from CMPD or neighborhood safety groups on possible remedies?
Well, this is something that has been a longer term trend in the last 5 years. It's really picked up. And, you know, the city and the county, to some extent, they've tried these violence interrupter programs where they're trying to, you know, have neighborhood advocates and local safety groups talking to people and trying to interrupt what police say is a cycle of, you know, petty arguments and violence, retribution that is fueling a lot of this. I think the thing that really strikes me is when you zoom out and, you know, look beyond year over year, I mean, it's something like a 15% increase this year, which is a lot, especially because most other large cities are seeing homicide totals go down
dramatically.
But if you zoom out and you look, you know, in the 2010s, homicide totals in this city were usually in the 50s or 60s. You know, 10 years ago, we got as low as 44 homicides. Now, every year, we're doing 100 or more, and it's become very routine for those homicide totals to be averaging in the triple digits. Those are numbers we haven't seen since the 90s. And, you know, when COVID started and there was kind of a nationwide spike in violent crime, I think people looked and said, wow, you know, it's been a bad year or two here, and maybe that'll subside. But we're 5+ years into this homicide spike in Charlotte, and it's not subsiding. This level of violence that is double or more the number of homicides that were common in the last decade has become routine. So I am kind of surprised it hasn't occasioned more public notice. I think it'll be interesting to see if anyone tries to make it any sort of issue in the Charlotte municipal elections that are coming up this year. But we've really gotten used to, unfortunately, I think, a much higher level of violence in this city compared to the previous two decades.
And Eli, I trust your math more than mine, but I think it is safe to say Charlotte's got a fast-growing population, but it hasn't doubled during that same time.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, if you look back at the record homicide years when Charlotte had 120, 122 murders, I think 126 might be the highest, but I'm not sure, in the early 90s, yes, the population was smaller then, so the rate was higher. The thing is, if you look at, like I'm saying, the 2010s, the city's population has not grown that much since the 2010s.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
And right. we've more than doubled the annual number of homicides many years.
Another set of grim statistics from the past week. Homelessness increased 18% nationally, 19% in North Carolina, including 9% in Charlotte. And Eli, as you know, local government and others have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years for housing. Given that, how disappointing are these numbers?
Well, I think it's part of a, like you said, a nationwide trend. This is one where, as opposed to homicides, where unfortunately we are moving against the trend, in this one, unfortunately, we are moving with the trend and seeing higher numbers. You know, there have been a lot of investments in housing first solutions, which are basically you try to get people into housing and then deal with things like drug addiction and mental health, as opposed to, you know, the approach of making people get clean first. You could argue those haven't worked given that the numbers are higher. But, you know, there's been national reporting, including on NPR in the last week, about how the Trump administration plans to shift federal funding away from housing first solutions and towards enforcement actions, clearing encampments, arresting people, trying to push people into treatment for mental issues, substance abuse issues involuntarily. So, you know, over the past few years, we've seen the focus on housing first, and now we're, sounds like, really going to see a different focus from the federal government on down. We don't have the crisis levels that you see in some, you know, West Coast cities that have gotten a ton of national press, but it's clearly, I think, moving in the wrong direction here in Charlotte and North Carolina.
Joe, I'm curious, do you have a sense yet? I haven't seen an agenda yet, but do you know if, do you expect this to be a big topic at the council retreat?
I think quality of life issues will be discussed at the retreat. I know on Monday, Charlotte City Council is starting with a discussion about crime and quality of life issues. So I would expect a more in-depth discussion at the retreat.
And speaking of housing for people in need, this week, former President Jimmy Carter died at 100 years old. His work with Habitat for Humanity through the Carter Work Project brought him to Charlotte's Optimus Park in 1987. Here's part of what he said then, courtesy of the American Archives of Public Broadcasting.
I think the whole neighborhood and maybe the whole city of Charlotte and a lot of other communities will be more aware of the needs of the homeless and also aware that people that are fortunate can actually do something about it.
Eli, I think you did a show on housing in the past week. How do you think housing explains Jimmy Carter's values?
Well, I've always been interested in housing as a reporter because it connects to everything. You know, you can't really get ahead in life if you don't have a firm foundation of somewhere to live. Housing connects to segregation. It connects to education with how schools are built. It connects to public safety. It even connects to public health. So I think that when you look at Jimmy Carter's worldview and his goals of creating a more equitable society broadly, housing is a really fundamental tool to approach those goals and a really fundamental lens to look through and see all those goals. So I think his approach really encapsulates that. Unfortunately, you know, you heard in that clip there, he hoped 30 years ago or whenever that was that we would be 36, 37 years ago that we would have this problem maybe not solved, but maybe made more progress on. And as we were just talking about before, you know, unfortunately, we continue to see more numbers of folks without homes and higher housing costs, more people struggling. So it reminds me of that old parable about, you know, the starfish, all the starfishes washed up on the beach and person's throwing them back. Another person comes up and says, how will you ever make a difference? There's so many starfishes. You'll never solve this. Person holds up a starfish and throws it back and says, well, I made a difference for this one. When I was thinking about Jimmy Carter's approach preparing for this show, that's the analogy that kept coming into my mind is he didn't solve the problems, but there are still people living in houses that he helped build in Optimist Park, and he made a difference for them.
And Alex Axios Charlotte included a different comment from Carter from that same visit in 1987. Carter said then, quote, we don't come here doing favors, nor do we come as a separate class of people. We are part of a community of Christian brothers and sisters, and that makes us thankful, end quote. And Alex, I think it was that feature was included his comments and visits to a number of cities across the country, correct?
Yeah. We had another memory from there when he was campaigning in Concord in 1976 of him wearing a white apron and flipping pancakes. But he certainly is most well known in Charlotte and remembered for his impact with Habitat for Humanity and the, you know, bringing hundreds of volunteers from across the country here at that time. And then the chapter, the Charlotte chapter of Habitat only formed a few years after that. So he definitely left a mark here.
Joe, you've been covering a lack of consensus, I guess we could put it, between the fire department and Medic. Their current contract ends January 9th, and CFD wouldn't legally be able to respond in Mecklenburg County without a new contract. Here's Fire Chief Reginald Johnson speaking last summer about Charlotte's growth creating challenges.
We're just looking for fair compensation, realizing that we have four EMTs on a unit. We're running 80,000 calls a year. I think being fair and equitable with the services that are being currently paid in the towns and the county, I think there just needs to be some consideration.
And here is Medic Executive Director John Peterson speaking to county commissioners in response to the fire department telling city government that Medic hasn't addressed the department's concerns.
This extension will also provide us an opportunity to evaluate all facets of the agreement during the county's regular budget cycle.
So Joe, take us through this. Help us sort out what are they fighting about and what is the time pressure that they are under now?
So if you call 911, if you're a fall victim, you're having a heart attack, oftentimes firefighters are the first to arrive and handle the immediate aftermath, do CPR, help you up, things along that nature. And they have a contract with Medic to respond to these calls. That contract expires in just a couple of days. And without that contract, they legally won't be able to go to these emergencies. So they're trying to renegotiate the terms, including, you know, how much money they get for responding to these calls with Medic. And there's just a contract dispute right now. It's possible it could be extended, the talks, but this has been going on for quite some time, these talks behind the scenes.
Do you get any sense of how big a financial gap we're talking about? You know, are they far apart? Are they a little bit? Can you tell at all?
I don't think they're close. I think there are some outstanding issues that the two groups really haven't been willing to budge on. So I'm not sure how this resolves itself in the short-term future. Hopefully they can at least extend the current agreement by a month or two while they continue to negotiate if they can't come up with a new deal in less than a week.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What do you do? I assume no one is going to just let all service lapse when there are emergencies, but maybe I shouldn't assume.
You know, I don't know. I'm sure Medic has a contingency plan, but Medic needs Charlotte Fire or somebody like Charlotte Fire to help them out with these calls.
And is the ultimate decision up to county commission, city government?
I believe so, but you know, whatever Charlotte Fire and Medic come to an agreement to, I don't think the overseeing body would step in and reject it.
Got it. Eli.
I just wanted to start 2025 with a space on the Charlotte local news bingo card, which is consolidated city county government. I mean, you know, stuff like this, I hear it and I'm like, you know, got Medic under the county, got CFD under the city. Why bother? You know, and that's something that seems to come up every 5 years or so, like some kind of cicada swarm coming out of the ground on a regular cycle. These discussions about greater unification of city county government. But this is just one area where I'm like, man, might have something to talk about here.
Yes, Councilman Malcolm Graham has been making noises about consolidation from time to time. So you may be onto something there, Eli. And I like the cicadas analogy. Eli, this week, Salisbury Mayor Karen Alexander died on Sunday at age 73 after being diagnosed with cancer in October. What stands out about her life and service?
Well, she was in her second term as mayor, nonpartisan elections up in Salisbury, and I believe she'd been on the council since 2013 there. She was an architect and founded her own firm. She was really praised by a lot of local leaders for her dedication to her city, her town, her community. She was praised by, you know, Ted Budd and Vi Lyles. And, you know, obviously, I think it says a lot about a local leader when they're getting praise from both sides, opposing sides of the political spectrum, for their dedication to their local community. And, you know, she's getting a lot of love from her community, and it sounds like she'll really be missed.
We need to take one more break. When we come back, more from the week in news, including the Panthers season finale. Can they win one before they take a break? But we're going to take a break first right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. This is the local news roundup with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Alex Sands from Axios Charlotte, and WFAE's Eli Portillo. Alex, you've just written about some of the biggest developments, real estate projects expected to start in 2025. Which of these are the highest interest to you as you look at this list?
Okay, I'm going to give you one that's going to finish this year and one that's going to start. I think probably the most impactful one to start is going to be the Iron District, 55 acres. It's going to be mixed use, hotel, residences, retail space, office. And the reason this is so big is because it's such a prime location between South End and Uptown, and it's really rare to see that much land that hasn't been built on yet. But they're just, I believe, starting infrastructure this year, so I don't think we'll see a lot of vertical construction. But if you've been to the that great exhibit about NASA,
yes.
Blumenthal, yes, that's what it's called, Blumenthal. That's where it is, and that thing is really cool, and I think that they've seen that people are now coming out to that area, and it's getting recognized a little bit. And then I think the biggest one to deliver is going to be the Pearl. That's that big tall building with the Wake Forest University logo on it. It's going to be Charlotte's four-year med school, and it's going to be a big research hub, and I think people probably don't know yet just like how much of a magnet that's going to be for the city and how much it's going to kind of turn us into this medical destination. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that, as it opens, some of the impacts of people coming and lots of visitors and students, and to just see that thrive. And I think there's going to be a lot of office come out of that too, because people want to be near that. So that could start driving some more office construction, which we haven't seen a lot of because there's so much vacant space right now.
And that is the first phase of multi-phases on the Pearl, right?
Yeah, there's definitely going to be more. I think the whole thing is 26 acres and it's going to be a mix of uses, but this is just the initial first two buildings.
Eli, did you have something? I couldn't tell if you wanted to say something or not. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, you know, I think a lot of these are big developments, and it'll be interesting to see how they perform and how quickly they go up in this higher interest rate environment. You know, a lot of commercial developments and commercial loans that looked great at 2%, you know, don't pencil out, as developers say, at 7%. So, you know, I think one thing I'm going to be looking for is how many of these promised developments break ground and how many don't in the next year or so, because a lot of them were I'm trying to think of a word here, and all I can think of is penciled. A lot of them penciled under those lower interest rates.
Yeah. Alex, you also highlighted some projects that have gone quiet, such as Brooklyn Village and 7th and Tryon. Both of those are obviously tied to county government. Let's start there. Where does each one of those stand?
Brooklyn Village, that's an interesting one. So I know I put this on my list of developments that have gone quiet, but they're not really that quiet because they have said they will start in 2026, but that is a huge delay from when it was supposed to start, and it's been pushed multiple times. But right now where that stands is the county commissioners had actually kind of brought up like, hey, is there a legal way out of this? And when I checked in with the county staff about that, they said that they had looked through the legal documents, and as far as they can see, the People's Corporation, which is the developer behind Brooklyn Village, they have done everything that they need to do and met all the requirements. Essentially, there's a clause in the contracts that say if the market's not up to par, then they don't have to start construction. And that's what they're using as their explanation.
Eli, you look like you want to jump in.
Well, I started writing about Brooklyn Village, I think, when they put out the RFP looking for developers for it in 2015. You know, I was, I didn't have any kids yet. I was barely married. I still had a lot more hair. So that's one of the ones that I look at and I'm like, huh, is this going to happen before my kids go to college? And that's one that I'm like, I don't know. It's been so long, and they have, there's been so little done on that site compared to where they were expecting to be at this point that, you know, it's hard to be, for me to be anything but skeptical of that.
And at this point, I think it's important to note that the developer got a very good deal on this land, and this land is very close to the project we just mentioned, the Pearl. So it is going up in value, and nothing's been built.
And Alex, as you look at that list of the quiet project, so to speak, which do you think, is that the one with the longest odds of happening, or which one do you think would be, you know, the biggest challenge?
Oh, well, I know I have the Charlotte Transportation Center in here, and that is like confirmed dead at this point. That was the project to build on top of the CTC, the Uptown bus station, and to put a tower up. And there was a huge debate, and it was a story that I think all of us covered for a very long time about, would the bus station go underground or above ground, or where would it go? I guess that was all kind of a mute point because that project is not happening right now. Right now, CATS is just considering doing basic, a little makeover to the CTC, and no big tower in any plans right now.
And Brent Cagle kind of dropped that as a, you know, it's a little bit of an aside in a meeting, just kind of casually. And then I think we sat up and said, oh my gosh, this is a big change. On Thursday afternoon in New Orleans, the college football Sugar Bowl was played a day later than scheduled after a terrorist attack in the French Quarter left 14 people dead and dozens of others injured in the early hours of New Year's Day. Tonight in Uptown, the Duke's Mayo Bowl will be played at Bank of America Stadium. CMPD Lieutenant Crystal Fletcher told reporters Thursday that there will be an increased police presence for the game.
After the tragic events in New Orleans, we even have put in more security planning. There have been a lot of meetings with all the people that I mentioned. So I want people to know that they will, when they come out, they will see a significantly increased presence, and we want people to come out and enjoy the game.
Joe, anything fans should be aware of as they head to the game tonight?
I'm interested in seeing the response. It brings me flashbacks to covering the Belk Bowls in like 2016, 15, 17. At the time, there were a lot of terror attacks in Europe, and there was some increased security and lots of stories around the security for the Belk Bowl as a result. It'll be interesting to see what the CMPD presence looks like, but they do have a lot of experience in securing events of this type. And I think if I was a fan attending the game, I would feel confident.
Moving on from football to political football, the Center for Economic Accountability, a watchdog organization, easy for me to say, this week handed out its annual Worst Economic Development Deal of the Year award for 2024. And guess who won? Charlotte City Government received the unwanted honor for the $650 million deal approved by council last summer to pay for renovations and improvements at the Carolina Panthers NFL stadium. According to the center, the award, quote, recognizes a state or municipal government subsidy of a private company in the name of job creation and economic growth that goes further than any other that year across the nation to exemplify the wastefulness and ineffectiveness of economic development subsidy programs, end quote. So Eli, I'll let you start. What was your reaction when you saw this?
We're number one. We're number one. No, I mean, they highlighted, I think, a lot of the issues that you see overall with stadium subsidies. You know, it's not a new thing to criticize those as being economically ineffective. And I think having such a large stadium subsidy, of course, kind of puts you automatically in the running for this sort of recognition. You know, one thing that I was interested by that they highlighted is kind of the, excuse me, Tepper's track record and, you know, the questions around South Carolina, where that $800 million Carolina Panthers, Charlotte FC combined headquarters deal fell apart and Tepper walked away. So that was a big issue that they had. They also highlighted the quick time frame and that, you know, there was not a lot of public discussion around it. They highlighted poor transparency by the city, and that's something that, you know, we've talked about in multiple areas in this show as well. I also really wanted to highlight the logo for this group, which for this award, I guess. It is a golden shovel, which you commonly see at groundbreakings. It is a golden shovel going into a large poop emoji. And I don't think you'll see that featured on any City of Charlotte or Panthers official letterheads or merchandise.
I think that is a very salient point. Joe, you and I, among others, sat through many of these debates, meetings, press conferences. I'm hoping that your memory can help us recall what were some of the answers, because all these things came up. What were some of the answers that we heard from city and Tepper Sports executives on why this made sense and why those things did not apply?
I think that their main argument is Charlotte is better off having the Panthers, Charlotte FC, and other big events at that stadium. And the stadium is old. It needed to be upgraded. And in Charlotte's mind, they are doing it in a way that kind of defies the logic of what other cities are doing right now with tearing down their stadium and spending even more money to build a new one that's domed and has all the bells and whistles. So I think that Charlotte won't be celebrating this award. I also think they won't agree with it.
Yeah, and do you remember, Joe, the comparison of the investment? Because it's an $800 million renovation with $650 million coming from city government. But then the two sides had factored in previous investments by Tepper and future investments, and that essentially got them to the same amount. Do you think that number was credible?
We don't really know what that number means because we didn't get like a detailed list of this. These are the projects that TSC is going to invest in over time. I don't have reason to believe it's not credible, but certainly would have loved to have had a little more information about how that number was come up with and what exactly we can expect to see from the private sector.
Eli, you've seen plenty of these arguments since you've been in Charlotte. One of the things that strikes me about not just the award, but the attention on this stadium deal is that at the same time we have $275 million, I think, going to the Hornets for the arena and a new practice center. And it seems comparatively, I mean, I know it is less money, but it's still a lot of money. Comparatively, it really just kind of didn't register. It didn't seem that controversial.
Yeah, I think, you know, to some extent it was overshadowed by the Panthers deal and the influence or impact of that. Just, you know, bigger number, more attention. There's also different ownership structures there. And also, I think historically there's been questions about, okay, is Bank of America Stadium used enough? Under Jerry Richardson, it was really only used for the football games and the Spectrum Center Arena, you know, as a smaller venue, but it's always had more stuff there. It's had monster truck rallies and different concerts and, you know, more public events and more reasons for people to go. I think David Tepper, you know, winning off the field, or however you want to put it, has had success with drawing more of the events to Bank of America Stadium. But, you know, I think that there has been more of a perception that, yes, the arena is for the Hornets, but you also get a lot of other stuff out of it as a city. Bank of America Stadium, it's like, well, it's for the Panthers, kind of only the Panthers. That's changed, but I think that that historical split is behind some of it as well.
Alex, we were just talking about a number of the high-profile projects from the real estate side. Any major incentives, debates you see coming up for real estate in the new year?
It'll be interesting now that Tracy Dodson is leaving the city, and she's going to the Business Alliance, so we won't get to hear her present on any big incentives, but I know that they just approved money for Providence Square like last month, right, in South Charlotte. So that could be a big project that makes a lot of changes to that the intersection off Providence Road at Sardis Lane. That will be the most recent. Anything else coming up? I don't know, does anything come to your mind?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point about Tracy. So, and we have, 51 weeks left to go through that. But before we close today, remember, this is our final Sunday with the Panthers until next season. They're 4-12. They're coming off a 48-14 loss last week to Tampa Bay, but they can play spoiler by beating the Falcons and keeping them out of the playoffs. So let's go around the table very quickly. What do we expect Sunday? Win or loss? Alex, I'll start with you.
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to be hopeful. Win.
Joe.
Panthers money line, Falcons choke.
Nick.
The only people I'm less hopeful for than my Chicago Bears are the Carolina Panthers.
That hurt. Eli.
Panthers lose by 56.
Somebody call FanDuel immediately. My thanks to Nick Oxner, Alex Sands, Eli Portillo, and Joe Bruno. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks, and have a great weekend, everybody.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.